I'm Julie Burstein. I am here for Leonard Lopate today. Now, you might be looking forward to devouring your jelly beans and chocolate rabbits this weekend, but have you ever stopped to wonder where the sugar coating in that bright yellow peep came from and what eating it might be doing to your body and your teeth? Okay, maybe we shouldn't be thinking about that, but we'll get some real information now because on today's Please Explain, we're looking at sugar, from how it's grown and refined to how it's metabolized. We're joined by Elizabeth Abbott. She's the author of Sugar, A Bittersweet History, and Dr. Wahida Karmali. She's director of nutrition at the Irving Institute for Clinical and Translational Research at Columbia University. Welcome to the show to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Elizabeth, where did sugarcane originally grow? Where did it come from?
It originally came from the South Pacific, and from there it went. It went all over the world through trade routes and so on, until it eventually got to the taste buds of Europeans when they were in the Crusades, for example, in the Middle Ages, and they loved it. It was so much sweeter and more delicious than the honey that had previously sweetened European food that it was sort of an instant success.
No, Wahida, Elizabeth just said it was so much sweeter. Chemically, is that true, that sugar is just much more sweeter and we receive it that way than honey or other things that we'd been using before?
There is a different degree of sweetness in honey and sugar, which is really sucrose. And honey has a fructose as well, a lot more. And so there's a little bit of a difference, but sugar is definitely sweeter than honey.
And Elizabeth, it sounds like that people always had a taste for sweetness, but sugar itself was this new sensation at that moment. And is that what then led it to cultivation, because people in Europe fell in love with it?
Yes, and what happened was, at first it was very, very expensive, so it was the food of nobles, and it was something that you had on nobles and you know, very wealthy people had on very special occasions, for feasts and so on. And there was a culture, it had power with it. If you showed off by serving a great deal of sugar at a feast or a dinner or something, and there were ways of presenting it, for example, in huge sugar sculptures in which a king might have a sculpture of, say, a horse or a castle made out of sugar. Very elaborate, not something that your average person could ever aspire to. But as it slowly trickled down through to the wealthier people and the less wealthy and the middle class and finally the lower class, it just conquered taste buds, and people demanded that they have it, and it became psychologically an essential food.
Wahid, I know I've heard people say, I'm addicted to sugar. Is that something that can actually happen? And Elizabeth, you were just saying, you know, people just really loved it. Can people find themselves just craving sugar?
There seems to be an association when there is a sort of a neurological similarity in response to either food or drugs in humans. So there seems to be an association, but you cannot really classify it as an addiction, at least for now. You know, we humans, scientifically it's been shown that humans are born with a preference for sweetness. You know, if you think of breast milk or even the commercial formulas, they contain a certain amount of the milk sugar called lactose. So from the time we are born, in fact, even before we are born, even the amniotic fluid is sweet, as I understand. And so humans are born with a preference for sweetness.
That's so interesting that even before we're born, we're kind of set towards a course of liking things that are sweet. Is there a nutritional reason for that? I mean, is it, you know, breast milk has lactose in it. Is that partly because our bodies need sugar?
Yeah, sugar is a fuel for the body. You know, it's a carbohydrate. So all carbohydrates, the sugar along with the starch and the fiber, they provide the fuel, and it's the body's main source of fuel. So, and regardless of whether the sugars are added or occur naturally like in fruits and milk, The body cannot tell the difference. So it is a very important source of fuel to the body. But of course, we don't want people to just drink sugar water. You know, we want them to eat foods that do have carbohydrates, but along with those carbohydrates, they're also packed with other nutrients that the body needs.
So does the body, do our bodies deal with sugar, say something where sugar is added, where cane sugar might be added, differently than we would, say, a very sweet peach or something like that?
No, the body doesn't know the difference. You know, they all, regardless of what form of carbohydrate you have, it has to be digested and become the simple unit called glucose. And regardless of whether you eat a sweet peach or you just have a can of soda, it's not going to tell the difference. But when you eat peach, you're having a fruit that has fiber and has lots of antioxidants and other vitamins that the body needs.
Elizabeth, when sugar became the rage in Europe, when you looked at it, did you also see that other things started happening in Europe? Did people's teeth started getting more decay and things like that? Or is that just something that we might imagine, given the things our parents told us about sugar?
It was actually noticed at the time, although the state of medicine was such that there were some people who said that, who recommended sugar as a toothpaste. So I think that the jury's out on how good dentistry was then. But what started to happen was that it didn't just happen in a vacuum. It happened in the context of the Industrial Revolution of the 18th century. And so people who had previously worked at home in cottage industry and so on, but the nature of the Industrial Revolution was that people went into factories and they had to stay there all day and work. So at some point during the day they had to eat. So it was quite a different form of eating than if you had eaten at home and there was a pot of food at home. And so one of the things that happened was that sugar fueled the Industrial Revolution in the sense that the workers developed a new way of eating, and that is that they would have sugared tea, sometimes coffee, but usually tea, which was cheaper, and it tasted really good, even if it was very weak tea and the tea leaves had been reused and so on, because the people were quite poor, and they couldn't afford new tea leaves. But with some sugar in it, it was hot, it tasted good, and with perhaps some bread and jam, or jam and maybe a little meat or a little cheese, they started eating this way, and they although it's not nutritious, it felt good. It certainly gave them the energy to get through more of the day, and so it completely, sugar and the Industrial Revolution together changed the way people ate in Europe.
As you're describing this, I'm having this horrible image of factory farms, the way that cows are fed so that they can grow bigger than they would on natural food. And it sounds like during the Industrial Revolution, sugar was the way to keep your workers working, even though they weren't getting nutrition.
But the difference is that factory farmed animals know that they're miserable, but that people, they knew they were miserable, but they did like the food. They did like their tea, and they did like their bread with jam, and they began to demand it. And it became something that they absolutely refused to do without. Hence, it had to be accessible, it had to be cheap, and that's where you get into the terrible history of the sugar slave trade, because there was no other way to make it cheap other than by having somebody produce it for almost nothing.
Hmm. Sugar impacts the development of dental caries, but it's actually multifactorial. So, the fluoride helps, and the toothpaste with fluoride helps, brushing teeth often. So dental hygiene is very important. So when you mentioned the Easter candy, Julie, I would say if people are enjoying it, make sure you brush your teeth and don't keep sucking on it all day long, because then you continue to have a problem, because you're lowering the pH in the mouth, increasing the acidity and getting those bacteria to cause the damage on the enamel. So as long as you, in fact, the bread that was mentioned, even if the bread sticks between the teeth, it stays there for a long time, and it ferments, it breaks down into sugar, and that can also be harmful and can have an impact on the development of dental caries.
I'm speaking with Dr. Wahida Karmali. She is Director of Nutrition at the Irving Institute at Columbia, and also with Elizabeth Abbott, who has written Sugar, A Bittersweet History. We are talking about sugar, and we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Let's take a call right now. We're going to go to Johanna from Huntington, Long Island. Johanna, you had a question for Elizabeth and Wahida.
Yes. My understanding is that the taste for sugar is, or for sweetness, is very old, and way before we were planting anything, and that is that usually poisonous plants, poisonous things, have a bitter taste, so that is, human beings tend not to like the bitter taste, whereas very, very rarely is there something that's poisonous which has a sweet taste, so that it was evolutionarily to our advantage to eat sweet things rather than bitter things. And that's why human beings developed that taste for sweetness. I'd like the people to comment about that.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, I think that's absolutely true, that it was, it's a warning, that the bitterness is a warning that something could be poisonous, and sweetness is an invitation, a suggestion that it could be good. So we have this, humans have this propensity to trust and enjoy things that are sweet.
Wahida, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful natural way of getting us to recognize you know, things that are good for us and will not be harmful to our health.
It's also interesting that we've taken these words and used them metaphorically, too, that sweetness is what we want from life. And if we are feeling terrible, we often are feeling bitter. So it's interesting that these things have gone over into the rest of our lives, too, not just what we eat. Elizabeth, can you tell us a little bit about what sugarcane is like and how it's grown? Is it a crop that's difficult to grow?
It's a very difficult crop to grow. It's a very environmentally unfriendly crop. It's a very thirsty crop. It requires a great deal of water. It's not very good for the soil. As it's grown in most of the New World, it tends to attract a lot of predator animals, such as beetles, cane beetles, and in Australia, the cane toad, which is actually a national enemy of Australia because it wreaks so much damage there. So it's a very difficult crop, yes, and it doesn't, unlike sugar beet, which is environmentally very quite friendly, and can be grown with lots of you know, eating vegetables and so on. Sugar cane is very difficult and has probably contributed more to environmental degradation than any other crop in the world.
That's remarkable.
Yes.
And is it still something? I know, actually, in Florida, didn't the governor just say he was going to buy out a sugar company so that he could protect the Everglades?
Yes, because the damage that the sugar company, the sugarcane producers in Florida has brought so much damage that it's come to that. And it's the same thing in Brazil. There's a danger of sugarcane planters who compete with ranchers, you know, for land, to just say, well, we'll just get more by going, or the ranchers go into the Amazon and cut it down. So it's a really huge problem, and of course, you know, we know what damage to the Everglades will do to the environment and to the Amazon and so on.
Wahida, is there a difference between the sugar from beets and the sugar from sugar cane in terms of our taste and also in terms of nutritionally how we deal with it?
Nutritionally, all these sugars are the same. And most of the sugar comes from the sugar cane, you know, a big percentage, and a smaller, maybe a third or less, comes from beet sugar. And I think it's so because of that, we eat more of the sugar from sugarcane. And I have actually tasted sugarcane juice, and it's very refreshing during the summertime. Add a little lemon juice to it, and you can still see, you can buy it in New York City at least. But I've never had beet juice. I had, you know, blenderized beets and eaten roasted beets, but I haven't had plain extracted sugar in liquid from beets alone. So there's actually no difference in taste as I know it. But if it's taken fresh from the sugarcane, crunching it down through a press, then the flavor is a little bit different.
You know, it's interesting these days in health food stores, you'll see things that are trying to get away from having sugar in them, so they'll say cane juice. And I wondered if that's just a euphemistic way of saying sugar.
Yeah, it's actually, they call it crystallized cane sugar or cane juice. Yeah, it's the same thing.
And so, Elizabeth, should we, if we're concerned about the environment, should we be looking for things that are sweetened with sugar beets?
You know, I have quite strong opinions about this. We can do that, but we can also lobby for or insist that we buy organic sugarcane. And that would solve the problems that are now found in the exploitative and really bad way that a lot of sugarcane is grown. Organic sugarcane, solves. It has to be certified, and it has to be environmentally friendly, and so on. And it will cost much more. Now, this is the whole point, that it will cost more. I consider that a really good thing. It's one of the few foodstuffs that I would like to cost way more than it does, because it would then not be exploitative, it would not be bad for the environment, and it would be much better for us because we would eat much less. As it is now, we eat, I think that the average American consumes 44 pounds of sugar a year. We eat it in things that we don't even realize we're eating it in. It's in 70% of manufactured foods. You know, it's just permeates our entire cuisine, which is really bad. So I would say we should be trying to insist that it be grown organically, and that the people who produce it should be fairly paid, and then we would eat less, and we would change the culture of sugar. It would go back to being something a more luxurious food, and one that we don't eat, you know, we don't stuff into ourselves all day long.
And we might not be making horse sculptures out of it, but we would be treating the earth and ourselves a little bit better.
Well, yeah, right.
Sugar is manufactured by so many different countries, and to get the regulations for all these countries and would be a difficult task, but it's something that needs to be considered, I think, as was mentioned.
I'm speaking with Elizabeth Abbott. She's the author of Sugar, A Bittersweet History, which is published by Overlook, and Dr. Wahida Kamali, who's the director of the nutrition at the Irving Institute for Clinical and Translational Research at Columbia University. And we're talking about sugar on this week's Please Explain. If you have a question, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692 or leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. We'll have more after a break. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate, and I am talking about sugar with Elizabeth Abbott, who is the author of Sugar, A Bittersweet History, and Dr. Wahida Kamali, who is the director of nutrition at the Irving Institute at Columbia. Now, Dr. Kamali, just before the break, Elizabeth noted that we eat about 44 pounds of sugar a year. And I noticed in the paper yesterday that the American Heart Association has said, wait a minute, we need to eat less sugar that's put into our food. Do you know why it is that people who care about our hearts might care about how much sugar we eat?
You know, if you just eat plain sugar, you're just getting calories and not getting all the other nutrients. So the research has shown that people who eat a lot of sugar, they can be a problem with meeting micronutrient requirements. And also, if people eat lot of sugar and more than the calories that they need to maintain a healthy body weight, it can lead to obesity. And obesity and heart disease are related. And also there is some association between having a lot of simple carbohydrate and increasing the blood fats called triglycerides, which is a risk factor for heart disease. So we need to think of, you know, how many teaspoons of sugar we are consuming. The intake of sugar has grown in the past few decades, and in the national survey data shows that in 2001 to 2004, the mean intake of sugar in Americans was about a little over 22 teaspoons per day, which is like 355 calories.
22 teaspoons, just the idea of putting that many teaspoons of sugar in my mouth just is, ooh.
But just listen to how many teaspoons 14 to 18-year-olds have. It's about 34 teaspoons.
So if you thought about like a can of Coke, how many teaspoons might be in that? Do you know?
About 10 teaspoons.
Oh, okay. Sugar. So 22 if you just have two sodas.
Yeah, but think of all the other things that you may be eating. You may be eating sweetened yogurt. You may be having some kind of a cookie, and so all these added sugars add up, you know. So you can easily get over 22 teaspoons. So what the American Heart Association has stated in the scientific statement is to decrease the amount of sugar and limit it to 100 to 150 calories, depending on whether you're a female or a male. The female gets fewer calories from sugar, like 100 calories. And so it's important for us to look at our overall diet just to make sure we are getting whole grains and fruits and vegetables and low-fat, non-fat dairy products and small amounts of meat, which lean cuts of meat. And that's really very important. Rather than just focusing on one thing, think of the overall diet. You know,
so diversity is what's important.
That is very important, because only then you can get all the nutrients your body needs. You know, so if you talk about sugar, don't lose sight of fat in the diet. You know, it's not just one thing that can cause health problems. And in fact, if you think of if there is a direct association between sugar consumption and health, there are really very few health concerns. What we should be, what we should remember is that if you eat too much from sugar, there's too many sugar calories, then you're going to gain weight. And you can, you know, increase your triglyceride levels, and you may not get all the nutrients your body needs.
Let's go to some calls right now. We've got a lot of people who have questions about sugar. I'm going to go to Adam in New Jersey. You had a question for my guests.
Yes, that's right. Here's my question. You guys are talking a lot about cane sugar and soda and whatnot. What about corn syrup? Could you comment on the difference between corn syrup and cane sugar, and whether or not nutritionally it's different, and whether there's public policy that points towards growing more corn, using it as corn syrup, and putting that in food. So if you folks could comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
So do you want me to go first?
Yes, please.
Okay. You go first, then I have a lot to say. Please.
Okay. Corn syrup is actually, corn really has a lot of glucose in it, but when it can be processed to convert the glucose into fructose. So you can have a corn syrup which is 42% fructose or 55% fructose. So it's really like sucrose, the table sugar that you have is glucose and fructose in equal amounts. So you have corn syrup which mimics the table sugar, and it's used in a lot of products these days. They calorically is the same, but it's very similar to the table sugar that you consume, the sucrose.
Elizabeth, what has the growth of the use of corn syrup done to the sugar industry?
Well, first of all, I have a list right in front of me of the sorts of things that high fructose corn syrup is in. It's in, for example, it's in Starbucks Frappuccino and Wonder Bread and lots of Kellogg's cereals. It's really Cool Whip and so on. It's in all kinds of things. What it's the sugar industry gets together as a lobby when it comes to policy, medical policy in terms of, for example, the World Health Organization or the American Health Organization, and how much sugar is good for you. They get together and they lobby, and they they lobby for very high percents to be established as healthy for you. For example, they want 20% of sugar. They want it to be said that, you know, up to 20% of a of your diet in sugar is good.
The sugar industry itself wants
the sugar
this.
Industry itself. Mm-hmm. They ally together because they're all sort of in the sweetness business. But in terms of but they're actually bitter enemies, because in terms of production, they are always fighting one, and so that they are trying to prove that each other has a product that is more fattening, or that will make you, the most recent one is that one will make you gain weight more than the other, and so on. So they're trying to look, come at it from that angle rather than the actual, you know, the actual nutritional value of it just being plain sugar.
Has this lobbying actually affected the food guidelines that we hear about? Have they been successful in getting us to think, well, you know, a certain percentage of sugar might not be a bad thing?
Well, the World Health Organization has it at 10%, and it was extremely difficult for nutritionists and medical doctors and so on to keep it that low, because there's a great deal of pressure put on them to, you know, to make it higher. In Australia, it's even harder. I believe it might be higher there. I'm not sure of that in the most recent guide. But it's all a lobbying thing. It's all political. It doesn't have anything to do with the medical, you know, with medical viewpoints. It has to do with an industry war and so on, but it's about at 10% now, and 10%. It's very hard to know how much we are consuming each day. We don't get up and look at the food guide. Why that's important is this: that if you are something like an old age home, if you're an institution and you are funded by the government, you have to abide in serving food in your diet, in the diet that you feed your residents, whether it's old age hospital and so on. You have to go by the food guides. So that sort of thing starts to really matter then.
Let's go to another caller. This is Linda in Pennsylvania. You have a question, Linda, about the different kinds of sugar.
I'd like to know when some of these other more refined sugar products came to be, and who came up with them, the confectioner sugar and the bar sugar. I cook with all kinds of sugars, you know, and you see these recipes now, they've been very, very old, candy, and making these cages, you know, crystallizing sugar so that you can make cages and various other structures. But confectionery sugar is in frostings and things like that. I was just curious, who came up with some of those? Was it the French, or how'd that happen?
Well, Elizabeth, do you have some thoughts on that, on how sugar came to be powdered?
Refining came about. It came about independently in different places. For example, in the Middle Ages, Egyptians knew how to make sugar sculptures. So they had obviously some methods of refining it. But that method, that technology, was lost, at least to Europeans who never had it. As it became more, it's really driven by culture. As it became more important to show off by having different kinds of sugar products, sugar became more and more refined. And the more refined it is, the easier it is to work with also, so that confectioner sugar is really, really soft and so on. And in the West Indies, different islands were known for the kind of sugar that they produced, whether it was, you know, a little less refined or more refined and so on, although it was, the ultimate refining was in Europe. There were still grades of sugar that were preferred by different classes, like confectioners preferred the higher level because it's easier to work with. So I don't know if that answers the question, but it was driven by the cultural need for making all sorts of different things. Hard candy, that you're talking about, boiled candies, came about and were really developed in the 19th century when children were seen as consumers, and the penny candy was a way to get children into consuming sugar. So a child doesn't have much money, but he might have one penny. And so that there were stores that had lovely boxes, bottles of a beautiful and different and interesting and delicious penny candy. Children were encouraged to go there and, you know, spend their one penny. And then they got hooked on sugar, let's say, on these candies. And then as they became older, they became consumers of sugar. So there were all different motivations. And women were told in the 19th century that to be a good wife, you had to serve your husband a dessert every day, and it had to be a sugary dessert. So if you were a really good wife, you would make lovely cakes and something refined. If you were a very busy good wife, you might serve Jell-O, which you only add water to, but you still get some sort of dessert. Again, sugar, 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 sugar.
So the social and the appetites were all tied up together, it sounds like. And the commercial as well.
And could I say one more thing? The biggest deliverer of sugar is soft drinks. So that's, you know how important that is in our culture. I'd like to buy the world a Coke and keep it company. It's like that Coke is, and it's, you know, the offshoots. Other kinds of soft drinks are conquering the world. And when they go into less developed countries, the same thing happens. They seduce the populations, and boom, the consumption of sugar goes up, and boom, so does obesity and so on.
Well, you know, the different forms of sugar also really help in the textures of different products. So depending on what your baking needs and your cooking needs are, I think molasses act differently versus honey or just granulated sugar or confectioner's sugar. So I think they all serve a purpose to make the food taste better and have better textures.
Now, Wahida, also we have room for just a couple of more points, but the further refined sugar it is then it further away from what you were talking about before, which is eating food in its natural state, eating fruit or eating something that has all of these other benefits as well?
Yeah, if you refine, just the plain sugar, regardless of what form it is, it's just plain calories, just simple carbohydrate. And so it doesn't give you the other nutrients that your body needs. So if you have too much of sugar, you're really going to be depriving your body of all those micronutrients that are essential.
But it sounds like we shouldn't starve ourselves of sugar either, that if we are going to imbibe, we just should brush our teeth this weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. Enjoy the Easter candy. Make sure you brush. Don't keep sucking on your lollipops, because the more it stays in your mouth, the greater the chances of fermentation.
Thank you so much. We're going to need to wrap up, but I've been speaking with Elizabeth Abbott, who's the author of Sugar, A Bittersweet History, published by Overlook, and with Dr. Wahida Kamali, Director of Nutrition at the Irving Institute for Clinical and Translational Research at Columbia University.